Good morning and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. This is Canon Sharon Alexander with the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. Every Thursday at 8 a.m., we interview people from all over, from Memphis and beyond, to learn more about the role that faith has played in their lives. We broadcast from WYXR 91.7 FM in Memphis, Tennessee. Today, we are starting a series on how the Episcopal Church is governed. One of the questions that I get asked occasionally is, what does it mean to be a denominational church? Primarily, what a denomination means is that it is a bunch of churches that are everywhere that are connected. They're connected in different ways, but with us, they are connected with a larger governing level at what a lot of people mistakenly call the national church. We are not a national church, not like the Church of England, but we are a denomination where we have an office, headquarters in New York. And then below that, we have what we call provinces. And then below that, we have what we call dioceses. And a bishop is in charge of the diocese. And then we have a number of parishes, a number of places of worship in each of those dioceses. Some of the larger dioceses have over 100 churches that are in that diocese, and some of the smaller ones just have around 20 or 30. What we do as a denomination means is that important decisions are made at different levels, and we are made in discussion with each other. We're not like the independent churches that we have around here, where they can just make a decision for themselves and go about that. They don't have to have the kind of process that we have for, say, bringing in a new clergy person. We have a book that has all kinds of rules and processes for how we ordain somebody, rather than some of the churches that some of you may know of, where you just see somebody that's been sitting in the pew for a while and they talk really well and they sound like they really know what they're doing, and often they do, and then they just get called to be the preacher for that church. With us, there is just a whole lot more that goes into the decision-making, and General Convention is our primary way of making decisions. We are about 1 week away from the day that the deputies and alternates from West Tennessee leave for Baltimore, Maryland to attend the 80th meeting of the General Convention of the Episcopal Church. And I'm honored to be one of those deputies. And this year I am serving on the Resolution Review Committee. The first General Convention that we had was way back in 1785 in Philadelphia. It meets every 3 years, and that has happened regularly every 3 years, except for last year. We had a meeting scheduled for 2021, and that was postponed for a year because of COVID. The General Convention is the governing and legislative body of the Episcopal Church, where the most important decisions for the church are made. It's divided into two different houses, similar to what we have in the U.S. Congress, but not exactly the same. The House of Deputies is actually the older house of the Episcopal Church's convention, and that was the only house that met at that first meeting back in 1785. From the very beginning, it was important for the church that decisions be made by lay people and by clergy and by bishops, so it's divided up between those three orders. The Episcopal Church is divided up into 111 dioceses. The General Convention is the governing and legislative body of the Episcopal Church, where the important decisions for the church are made. The General Convention is divided up into two houses, sort of similar to what we have in the U.S. Congress. The House of Deputies is the older house, and that was the only house that met at the initial convention back in 1785. And from the very beginning, the Episcopal Church thought that it was important that important decisions not be made just by bishops, but they also be made by lay people and clergy. And so what we have in the church is a division of 111 dioceses, which are in the U.S. and several other countries. Each diocese gets to send 4 clergy deputies and 4 lay deputies, as well as a few alternates. The House of Deputies is chaired by a president who is elected at the convention, and each of the presidents may serve up to 3-year terms. And this year we happen to have a president of the House of Deputies who has used up her 3 terms, so we will be getting a brand new one. The House of Bishops is the other house, and that first met at General Convention in 1789, and they had a total of 3 bishops at that one, so it wasn't a very big house. Now we have well over 100, sometimes even 200 when we have the retired bishops, the assistant bishops, and all of those attending. The House of Bishops has its chair, and that's our presiding bishop, who is elected by the House of Bishops, and the election then has to be confirmed by the House of Deputies. As many of you may know, our presiding bishop is Michael Curry. Many people know him as the one who did the royal wedding a number of years ago, and he is regularly making statements that you can see if you look at the Episcopal Church's website. Our presiding bishop, Michael Curry, will be interviewed on Faithfully Memphis later this year. And so sometime by the end of the year, you will get to hear an interview with him. And that's something for all of us to look forward to. Michael Curry is near the end of his 9-year term. He's actually got 2 more years to go. So he will be stepping aside at the next general convention, which is going to be in 2024 in Louisville, Kentucky. And that will be a big election that we're going to have. And one of the pieces of trivia that I have for you this morning is that our bishop, Phoebe Rofe, is on the nominating committee for the next presiding bishop. So she will be one of the ones who is helping to make a decision as to who the next presiding bishop will be. And if you need 2 pieces of trivia for today, I can also add that Deborah Harmon Hines, who has been interviewed on Faithfully Memphis before, is also on that committee. So we are incredibly fortunate that here in West Tennessee that we have not just 1, but 2 representatives to help make this really important decision for our church. I get asked all the time, what does the presiding bishop do? The first thing to know is that he is not an Episcopal Pope. He doesn't get to sit in the chair of St. Peter or anybody else and make decisions for the church. Instead, what he does much of his time is he helps set the vision for the church, and he also guides the implementation of what the General Convention has decided. So there will be a number of things that are decided at our General Convention. Both the presiding bishop and the president of the House of Deputies get together out after that and help guide how those things are going to be implemented. Now, another question I get often is, how does the convention make its decisions? And the primary way it does that is by passing resolutions, and the resolutions have to be approved by both the House of Deputies and the House of Bishops. Now, these resolutions might propose amendments to the Constitution or to the canons of the church. They might propose changes in how we worship, or they might request forming new ministries or new efforts that we have, or they can sometimes they do things like ask the church to state its position on any number of issues that we might have. These can be issues about the environment, about violence, about equality, about racism. We have a number of things that over the years the Episcopal Church has said this is what our stance is. Another thing that happens at the General Convention meeting is that a 3-year budget is approved for the Episcopal Church. Finally, the last thing that we do a lot of is we spend time electing people to a variety of positions, including the Executive Council, which serves as the board of directors for the church, and also leadership positions for the church pension group and other groups. After the convention, we will have on our website links to the resolutions and to the people who have been elected. These will be on the Episcopal Church's website, but we will provide a link for those for any of you who want to have further information about General Convention. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing an old friend of mine, Molly James. Molly is the Deputy Executive Director of the General Convention Office. And that's a long title, Molly. Before you tell us what you do now, tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what your involvement in the church has been.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you today. Thank you. I grew up in a very small town in rural Maine. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was a teacher, and they had a farm and grew blueberries on the side. My connection to the Episcopal Church is through my dad's side of the family. He's really the one who went to church. So I went to church with my dad at a wonderful small parish in the next town over. And the priest who baptized me as an infant was there in that parish until I was 20. He was a really wonderful man and one of those people who just incarnated God's love and grace. And in his presence, you knew everything was going to be okay. And I would give him quite a lot of credit for the reason I ever considered being a priest.
So that is something that you thought about as a kid. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut. That obviously didn't happen.
Well, at first I thought I would be a teacher, or maybe I did a bunch of theater in high school and I loved doing that. So maybe theater or film. I had bone cancer when I was a teenager. And out of that experience, I knew I wanted to spend my life working in a community that understood the sacredness and the fragility of life. At first I thought maybe that would be the medical community, but science is not my strong suit. I was a psych major in college and I loved that. And God was missing. So I began to think about going to seminary, and my childhood priest is absolutely the reason why that possibility of a path occurred to me. And I ended up going straight from college to seminary. So I didn't initially think of it as a small child, but I certainly did end up there pretty quickly from college.
You know, we have talked a little bit about your history with bone cancer, and I never imagined I would be in Memphis, where we have St. Jude just right down the street from our office, and to see God working in that setting. And it sounds like that you had a pretty powerful experience with God during your time with bone cancer.
I did. And I will give great thanks to St. Jude, because they trained my pediatric oncologist. He was trained there. So I'm here today because of the amazing work that St. Jude's does. I did have a very profound experience. It certainly invited me to come to grips with my own mortality at an age when most of my peers were pretty sure they were invincible, and they were pushing the envelope to sort of see what was possible in life. And I was pretty clear where the limits were. So it made it a challenge with my peers for a while there, but it ultimately ended up really deepening my faith. I had a very strong sense of God's presence with me in the course of that experience. I think at the age of 13, I didn't have good vocabulary for what that was, but I certainly felt that presence of being in the care of something much bigger than me or my family or my doctors, all of whom were wonderful and gratefully supportive, but it really did have this sort of sense of being a part of something much bigger. And that was a real gift. And it was clear from then on that I wanted to spend my life working and being around people who shared that sense of meaning and the sacredness and fragility of life, and had a shared sense of what really mattered.
That is a powerful, powerful story. And so take us from being a 13-year-old to being ordained. You worked first in parish ministry, right? And then you wound up doing some things that most priests don't do.
Yes. I very initially was a hospital chaplain. And in fact, I thought maybe that was going to be my career path, and then discovered that I was not cut out for ministry at the pace of hospital chaplaincy. And also that I wanted more in my theological toolbox. And so I did what I love, which is to go back to school, and got a PhD in theology, and did work part-time in a parish and loved that work as well while I was getting my PhD. And then I finished that and moved on to working for the Bishop of Connecticut. I started first in an administrative role. And then when he redesigned the ordination process in Connecticut, they decided they needed a staff person to sort of be in a combination of sort of admin and academic oversight of the ordination process. And so I got to step into that role, which was really wonderful, and have the opportunity to sort of develop the new ordination process in conversation with the bishops and the Commission on Ministry and people across the church. It was really a fun experience and a wonderful experience, and really meaningful to have the opportunity to be a part of forming future generations of clergy.
And then you wound up going to General Convention.
I did. I got elected as a deputy for General Convention in 2015. And, you know, one of those remarkable moments in life, Gay Jennings, who's our president of the House of Deputies currently, came to do Ian's, my bishop's, evaluation. And I gave her a ride from the airport when she came to do Ian's evaluation. And we got to talking. She got to know me. And so out of that experience, I got appointed as first to a standing commission in 2012 to 2015. And then when I was a deputy in 2015, to the Legislative Committee on Governance and Structure, which is where we met. And I got the great privilege of working with Sally Johnson and Tom O'Brien and Tom Little in the leadership of that, and discovered what I thought was true, which is that I really love all that governance structure, constitution and canons stuff, that yes, truly, I am a church nerd and I love all that stuff. And so that was just great. It was challenging work and really fun. And so then out of that, I got to be on the standing commission between 2015 or after General Convention in 2015, the standing commission on structure, governance, constitution, and canons. And I really loved that work and stayed involved with that work all the way through also being a deputy in 2018. So,
yep. And then you were supposed to be the chair of it, and you wound up with another job. So I wound up having to do that. And
yes,
I won't say I curse your name for that. I have appreciated the opportunity to do that. But you had to step aside because
I was hired to be the deputy executive officer of General Convention. So I am Canon Michael Barlow's deputy in the General Convention office. And so the way I like to say is I got to make my church hobby, which was all things constitution, canon, governance, structure, et cetera. I got to make my church hobby my job. And it's fabulous. And it's so much fun. It's a great team of colleagues. And there's so much diversity in the portfolio of the General Convention office that there are no 2 days are the same. And it's really just fascinating. I loved working on a diocesan staff, as I imagine you do, because you get to see a sort of bigger picture level, and you get to see how the church life is diverse and all the things that connect us and all the things that we share all across the diocese and in conversations with colleagues across the church. And then working in the General Convention office, it's just more of that. It's really working at a sort of bird's eye view of the church. And it's just fascinating and so much fun and really wonderful to see the breadth and depth and diversity of the church, and to know how much is shared and central for all of us, even in our various geographic locations and all the ways in which our tradition has been adapted over the years, but that there's still so much central that binds us together.
So General Convention office, obviously that has to do with planning and running General Convention, but what are some of the other things that you do?
Sure. So our office is also sort of data central for the Episcopal Church. We collect all the data from congregations and dioceses each year that is put in the parochial report and the diocesan report. So we have data from across the church every year, new sets of data. And we also participate in some broader ecumenical and interfaith studies of congregational life. So pieces of my work include that participation and getting to look at the data and think about the data and figure out how we can use that data well in our life and planning as the whole church, really. So that's lots of fun. Then obviously between General Conventions, there are the Executive Council and lots of boards and commissions and task forces that meet in person and online. And we plan and assist with all of those bodies in their work and their meetings. This year, that has looked like supporting lots and lots of Zoom meetings as the legislative committees, which normally wouldn't meet until they got together in person at General Convention, have begun their work online. They started gathering in the fall and have been holding hearings since the middle of February. And so some of the work that would normally happen and will still happen at General Convention in person has already begun online. And so there's been a lot of logistics to help make that happen, which is really wonderful because the fact that it's all online means that people from all across the church can participate in the legislative process, whether they can get to Baltimore in July or not.
And I've found that we're able to have some deeper and longer conversations than having it all crammed into just a short period of time during General Convention. So I love the fact that we're able to bring in more people to give input and that our discussions really are much more in depth than we were able to do before.
Yeah. That's great. And then the other primary piece of my role is, so Canon Barlow also serves as the registrar of General Convention, which means our office has a role in making sure all the proper procedures are followed in the election and the consecration of the new bishop. And that's really one of the most fun parts of my job is at a bishop consecration, all the bishops present make a wax seal and sign their signatures on the new bishop's ordination certificate. And it's just like what someone might picture out of a history book or Harry Potter, you know, parchment and red wax. It's that part is really fun and I love it a lot. An interesting one that's changed a bit over the course of my tenure. So it used to be that we shipped a huge suitcase with the ordination certificate and a hot plate and a pot for the wax and all the supplies and the thing. And is this big black box that we used to ship to each diocese. Well, in December of 2019, we had a consecration in Helena, Montana. So I get to show up at the rehearsal in Montana. There's no black box. It was still in your neighborhood. It never left the FedEx facility in Memphis. And so I'm calling, you know, back to the office, my colleagues in New York who are graciously talking to me, even though, you know, it's Friday evening in on the East Coast. And we're trying to figure out what to do. And first we thought, well, maybe we could just wait and they could, you know, the bishops could sign and seal the certificate at the next meeting of the House of Bishops. Was a good thing we didn't decide to do that because that was December of 2019. You know when the next in-person House of Bishops meeting was? March of 2022. So that would have been a very long time for that person to wait for their ordination certificate. So then instead I thought, all right, well, we're going to figure out how to do this locally. So I went and got the certificate emailed to me. I went and got it printed. I went to a, you know, hobby and craft store and bought a wax glue gun that wax in, you know, in glue stick form, like, and the archival ink and purple ribbon. And we did it on, you know, with a few hours notice and did all of it the next morning. And, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. Discovered that actually the glue gun was much easier way to do it. And if I got the right setup, and which is what I have now, I have the little glue guns with the same kind of wax we used to use in the pot, same, you know, same company, same wax. And it packs down into this little thing I can put in my suitcase. So I travel now with the certificate and the glue gun and the wax and the pens and the ribbon and everything. So then I never have to worry anymore about whether or not the supplies are going to be there when I need them.
And this is a big deal, isn't it, for these bishops to collect their little wax?
Yes.
Because I remember when you were here, in fact, I think Bishop Phoebe's was one of your first, wasn't
she? She was my very first. And there were more than 20 bishops there. So I got to like dive right in to figure out how to do this well, because I had to fit 20 some odd wax seals on her certificate.
And some of them have some kind of interesting ways they do this. I mean, some of them lick their ring. Others do all kinds of little, I mean, you mentioned.
Or they drop it in a glass of water, right? To keep the wax from getting down into the intricacies of the seal.
Yeah, I've seen this and it does look very Harry Potter. So who would have thought that this was an important part of being a bishop, but it apparently is.
It is. And I think it's a fun piece to do, a wonderful thing for them to keep. And then we take another copy that stays in the archives, and a really nice way for them to have this sense of being welcomed into the whole House of Bishops, of this collegiality of a collegial group, and a real sense of wonderful sense of community.
So that actually sounds like kind of a fun part of your job that you get to do.
It is fun. It is really fun and creative, and you know, and I love to cook too. And there's a bit of like figuring out the right temperature of the wax and like getting it in the right shape. And it's not dissimilar to cooking in that way. And it's sort of a bit of a creative outlet, which is really neat.
Well, I know that you and your daughter make some amazing cookies. So,
oh, thank you.
I do appreciate that. Those have gotten me through occasionally when I have needed a good sugar fix. So what is the most fun part of your job?
Well, I think that's definitely in terms of a particular activity, that's one of the signing and sealing. I also think that the fact that I get to work on a team, I think that's my favorite way to do ministry, is on a team. It's one of the things I've, you know, loved about the legislative committee work, about the way General Convention works, that it's stuff accomplished as a group. It's not an individual endeavor. And as you well know, sometimes priesthood can be lonely. And the wonderful thing about being on a diocesan staff, or in this case, in the staff of the GCO, is I really get to be a part of a team. And there's just a wonderful collegiality and synergy there. And things are better because ideas are shared and collaborative. And we can certainly have that as parish priests, but it often takes a lot more work on our part to construct that for ourselves, to have that same kind of team. And in this kind of ministry, it just is there in the inherent structure of the office to be a collaborative team. And that synergy is just brings a lot of joy.
How big is your team there at the General Convention office? And I know that that's just one of your teams. That I mean, you've mentioned these interim bodies and everything else. You've got a lot of teams.
I do. That's a lot of fun. So our office is 10 people in the General Convention office, and then obviously the bishop consecration piece is a piece I'd share with the presiding bishop staff as well. So I get to work especially closely with some colleagues on the presiding bishop staff as a part of that work. So wonderfully, there are days when the team gets even bigger in that way.
So one of the big things that you all do is coming up in July, and that is you oversee the workings of General Convention and try to make it run as smoothly as possible. Now, one of the things that we're doing in some of our radio shows is to try to help educate people about the polity of our church. And that word polity confuses people when it really means just how we govern ourselves, right?
Right.
That, you know, the United States, we could say we're a federal republic or a democratic republic and a representative government. And that's really what we are, is a representative governance, isn't it? By laity, by clergy, and by bishops. And that makes us a little different from a lot of the other parts of the Anglican Communion.
Right. And from other ecumenical, you know, colleagues, right? We're not the only ones with bishops, right? Catholics, Methodists, Lutherans also have bishops. Of course, it's probably important to note that, right, that's where we get the name of the Episcopal Church, is from the Greek word episkopos, which means bishop or overseer. So we were clear from the beginning when we separated from the Church of England that we wanted to keep the bishop part. We wanted to be Protestant, right? There's that really long official name of our church, the Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society of the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States of America.
Now, that doesn't look very good on a welcome sign, does it?
No, it doesn't fit very well. You can't really say anything else on the sign other than, you know, the name. So, yeah, so we've shortened it. We just normally refer to ourselves as the Episcopal Church, which is a little less of a mouthful. But that Episcopal piece there, yes, we wanted to hold on to some Protestant identity from the Reformation. And we also wanted to hold on to the importance of bishops in our tradition. So we do have bishops like so many others in our ecumenical colleagues and in the Anglican communion, but we do have a far more democratic structure than most other churches that have bishops. Nobody gets to be a bishop without a whole lot of people thinking it's a good idea. They have to be elected to that position. And that's, you know, well, first they have to have been ordained as a deacon and a priest, and then they have to be elected as a bishop. So a whole lot of people along the way have to think it's a good idea. So nobody gets into any positions of leadership without there being, you know, multiple voices in that process, whether it's the rector of a new parish, the senior warden, which we would say, right, is the head of the local board in a parish, or the bishop. So there's no getting to senior leadership in our church without the voice of a lot of people involved. And in fact, we would say the most senior voice, the most authoritative voice, earthly voice, right, after God, in the Episcopal Church is the General Convention. It's not a person. Lots of people know the Episcopal Church because of our beloved presiding bishop and his preaching and the royal wedding and elsewhere that has, you know, helped to put the Episcopal Church on the map, so to speak, and helped to get, you know, the message of our tradition out more broadly. And he's not our Pope.
That's right. That doesn't want to be, from what I hear.
No. And so it's lots of people together that make the decisions that are authoritative for us. There's no one person who can decide something that's about what we believe as Episcopalians or how we're going to govern ourselves.
That's right. I have occasionally get questions like, well, why doesn't the presiding bishop just make the bishops do this or that? And he really doesn't have that power, does he?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't have the power to tell bishops at the local level in their diocese how to govern. Or there's a lot of local autonomy, both for individual bishops in their diocese, and then their governance is shared among councils and standing committees and other leadership. Like, it's really shared leadership at all levels of the church.
And the real focus of our power, like you said, is our general convention that's coming up in Baltimore this summer. And will the people listening here be able to follow this? How will they be able to know what we're doing?
Sure. Well, they can absolutely follow it online. Lots of information is already available and will continue to be available at the General Convention Office website, which is www.generalconvention.org. Then all the official social media channels of the Episcopal Church will also have more information about convention, as well as the legislative sessions of both houses, right? We are a bicameral system, so House of Bishops and House of Deputies are live streamed. Fascinating to see how different the houses are in their manner of conducting business, and then fascinating to watch how they talk about the same issues differently, right? Because every piece of legislation has, in order to become an active convention and become, you know, official policy, has to go through both houses. Some things don't make it out of one house, but the things that will become a part of our doctrine, discipline, worship, our common life, our shared governance, all of those things will have gone through both houses. And it's really fascinating to see how they make it through that process.
Yeah, and we use that word legislation in a way that people might, they're used to it being used in a different way when we're talking about our state legislatures, because we're talking about how we might be amending our constitution and our canons and our rules of order, which are kind of the what you called earlier the governance nerdy stuff, how we organize ourselves. But it also includes our resolutions, right? We've got a wide variety of those, don't we?
We do. We have a wide variety of those, and many of them speak to current issues of the day and offer ways for the church to respond to crises in the world and to make it clear what we believe as Episcopalians about the rights and dignities of every human being. It was resolutions at General Convention, right, that allowed you and I to be ordained as women. It was resolutions at General Convention that changed our prayer book to the one that I've known for my whole life. It wasn't, you know, we didn't always worship in exactly the same ways that we do now. It's that General Convention that has authorized the blessing of same-sex unions. Lots of changes over the course of the history of the church have happened because General Convention passed a resolution to say, this is how we're going to do these things as a church. And these are the ways in which these new developments are in line actually with longstanding beliefs and central truths of what we believe as Christians and as Episcopalians.
And we really do hit the current events back in Austin in 2018. We not only had resolutions about immigration, but we actually went and had an event.
We did. We went to the detention center outside Austin, a very large contingent of us from convention, and just made a witness there to say, we are here and we see you and we support you. And that detention center, I believe, largely held women at the time, and in many cases of whom were separated from their children. And it was very powerful. We couldn't get very close, but we could get close enough for them to see us, and we could see them, and we could see their, you know, see their hands on the windows, acknowledging, you know, that they knew we were there. And we heard from people involved that how meaningful that was. And we had in Austin a really wonderful opportunity to work together as women, particularly, and with wonderful male allies, to have a significant number of resolutions come to the floor of both houses and pass both houses around in response to the Me Too movement, and resolutions that were created to really address, you know, issues of justice around the ways that women and others had been treated over the course of decades in the Episcopal Church. And I think that was a wonderful example of how we can accomplish so much more when we work together. The united effort of lots of women deputies and lots of others wanting to support that same work and that same change and that effort at addressing past injustice really made a profound impact across the church.
And it's not just the resolutions that come out of it, but the fact that we've had people together discussing this in real time and sometimes in a very raw way.
Yes. Yeah, there was very powerful testimony in legislative committees in the listening session that the bishops hosted in Austin and on the floor of both houses to speak to the tragic injustices of the past and to ways of going forward differently.
That ability to look back and say, wow, we did some things in the past that we really shouldn't have. And now we are absolutely committed to finding a way forward. That's one of the things I love about our church and that we take very seriously. And we never really know what's going to unfold at General Convention until it actually happens. But I'm imagining that there will continue to be concerns about what's happened the rest of the world and what the future of our church is and how we participate in the greater society.
Absolutely. I think there will be, I'm sure that there will be resolutions to talk about the things going on in the world in terms of social justice and international policy, as well as resolutions of what's, you know, about what's going on and the things that we need to grapple with, both in terms of our own history as a church, as well as American society and the societies in the other parts of the world where the Episcopal Church is as well. You know, there was a report just recently released from a working group on truth, reckoning, and healing, looking particularly at the issues and realities of systemic racism in the church and ways in which we need to grapple with our own history of complicity with oppression and white supremacy, and conviction that we can do that work and we can go forward in a different way. And there's some significant resolutions that have also come out of that working group that I think will have a lot of discussion and attention at General Convention.
You know, you mentioned a bit ago about how our deputies, how our dioceses are not all U.S. dioceses.
Yes.
Dioceses all over the world. You know, we have Taiwan, where right now they're, and always have been, concerned about what might happen if China becomes more aggressive. We have Central and South America, where massive poverty affecting our immigration issues. We've got Cuba, which is, we brought them in Austin.
And yes.
They have issues that are different from ours. And since I've been following General Convention and been part of it, we're doing more to try to recognize that and bring that into our discussion as well.
Yes. I think that very important for us to remember, right, that we are not just the Episcopal Church in the United States of America. We stretch from Taiwan all the way to Europe, and we have congregations in lots of countries and other parts of the world. And that's really important for us to remember in our work, and important also for us to note in how we do our work in ensuring that everyone can fully participate. So we have interpreters, and we have at convention, and we have materials that will be translated into Spanish. Our Spanish folks, there's Spanish speaking folks for whom they need written materials. Thus far, the deputations from Haiti and from Taiwan, so French speaking and Mandarin speaking, are good with written English. So we're okay on written material will only be translated into Spanish, but we will have interpreters, so spoken interpretation in Spanish, French, and Mandarin at convention, in order to fully allow everyone to participate and really be a part of that wonderful democratic governance of our church.
And this is a good time for one of my favorite reminders that we use a shorthand that we often shouldn't use, which is to talk about the national church. And we are anything but a national church.
Right.
And it's something deep in our vocabulary, but it's actually got colonial implications to it, and that our members in Taiwan or Haiti or Honduras are all as much members of the Episcopal Church as those of us in the States.
Yes. Yep. The Episcopal Church is much bigger than just the 50 states in of the United States. Absolutely.
One of my favorite things, and in fact, I would love to know if you can tell this, is how you determine where the different deputations sit. And the reason I say that is that for the last two conventions, I was with Louisiana, and we were seated next to the international deputations, and that was a lot of fun. So if we could do that for West Tennessee, that would be really nice.
Thank you. Where do the deputations seat is not a function of the General Convention Office. That is a function of the Office of the President of the House of Deputies. So perhaps you should bring her for a future radio show, and you can discuss the intricacies of the House of Deputies.
I was hoping I could lobby you for that, but that's just one of the things that I love about General Convention, though, is to be able to talk to people not only from all over the U.S., but all over the world, and see that we have very similar problems and sometimes very, very different ones and very different contexts, and to realize that God is working in all of these and that the Episcopal Church has a role in that. So you mentioned the President of the House of Deputies. We're having some elections come up this General Convention, aren't we?
We are. She has reached the end of her term. It was supposed to only be 9 years, but because General Convention got postponed from 2021 to 2022, she will have served 10 years as the President of the House of Deputies. And we do have term limits in the Episcopal Church. So that's the end. She has served three terms, and that's the end of her term. So we will be electing a new President of the House of Deputies at General Convention, which will be, I think, a really exciting opportunity for a new voice in leadership. And we're really marking the beginning of a real transition for the whole church, because we will elect a new President of the House of Deputies here in 2022. Our presiding bishop will retire in 2024. So there's a significant shift in leadership will be happening in our church in the next few years. And of course, every General Convention, we elect new members to Executive Council and to the other boards that have involvement in the governance of the church. So there will be a lot of new leadership as after July.
And we already have a committee that's working on the election of the presiding bishop. Our Bishop Phoebe is on that committee. And just tell us a little bit from a 50,000 foot level, how that works, because while the House of Deputies has to confirm it, we don't actually vote for that. So how does that work?
No. So the presiding bishop is exactly what presiding bishop says. It's the president of the House of Bishops. It's the person who presides over the House of Bishops. Now, over the course and initially and historically in the church, that's really all that person did was just to be the person who presided over the meetings of the House of Bishops. Over the course of our history, that has grown into a much more significant role, sort of as the senior leader in the church. And if you go through, I believe the phrase presiding bishop occurs like over 300 times in our canon. So there's a lot of things that the presiding bishop does and a lot of is it role. It's a role with the House of Bishops, has a role with the executive council, with the governance of the whole church. And much of that governance is shared, you know, with the president of the House of Deputies as the sort of vice president of executive council and the vice president of the Domestic and Foreign Missionary Society, which is the corporate entity that is the Episcopal Church. And that person is only elected by the House of Bishops, as you said, right? The House of Deputies has to confirm, but that person is only elected by the House of Bishops. So there will be a search process of sorts or transition process in the next couple of years, not dissimilar to how a bishop is elected at a diocesan level. There will be opportunities for the whole church, including at General Convention, to have input with the committee that Bishop Rofe is on and share what they want in their next presiding bishop and what are the issues in the church that they feel are most important and what are the attributes that they would like in the next presiding bishop. And there will be a profile created. And then there will be an opportunity for bishops, current bishops, who's elected does already need to be a bishop. There will be an opportunity for bishops to be nominated, and then they will put forward a slate in the spring of 2024, and the House will vote on a new presiding bishop. And then presumably the House of Deputies will confirm that vote. I'm not sure, actually. We should consult some of our fellow church nerds if there's ever been an instance where they didn't confirm it.
I am not aware of any being one of those church nerds, but there are some nerdier nerds than
yeah. We might ask them, but I don't know of any either. So I trust that 2024 we won't do that for the first time in 2024. I think this is the committee that's already at work is wonderfully collaborative between bishops and clergy and lay people. So I think it will be a good effort reflective of the whole church.
Well, it will be sad to see Michael Curry leave his position. He has done amazing work as our chief evangelist.
Yes.
He has helped lead the church through some very difficult years here. So he has earned his rest and retirement in all kinds of ways. And I look forward to seeing who we have next. So what is your favorite thing about General Convention?
I think is just how big it is and how it's exhausting and inspiring and so much fun. And I think it's a wonderful combination of realizing, right, how much one vote matters, how much each of us as individuals can have an impact in the common life and governance of our church. And, you know, as we were talking about earlier with, you know, historical efforts to remedy injustice and, you know, bring, you know, women to the floor of the House of Deputies and then women into the clergy and all those things, those happen because lots of people work together. And so there's also this wonderful sense of teamwork and realizing what we can accomplish together is so much more than what we could do as individuals, although what we can do as individuals also matters a great deal. So I think that sense of a collective impact is really one of the things I love most about General Convention, not to mention just sort of the opportunity to see wonderful friends and colleagues from across the church and just to be in the same place with people who love our church is such a gift.
I love that part of it. It is just how many new people I meet, how many new email addresses I get, how many people are friending me on Facebook because of that. My life and my role as a priest is just much richer because of all of that. I mean, just happenstance that you and I happened to be on the same committee a couple of conventions ago and have worked together. That's that's a real testament to what our church can do in ways that have nothing, well, not nothing to do, but that are not as related to our Sunday worship, that, that we're far more than that. Do you have anything that you would like to add? Because I would like the stump the canon question, if you've got that. That's something that usually stump the bishop. So I've planted a question with Molly.
All right. So it is great fun to get to stump the canon. So today we have about 415 pages. If you add up all the pages in the Constitution, the canons, and the rules of order for each house and the joint rules. When was the first constitution and canons approved, and how many were there?
It was back in 1793, and I loved reading these. The very first constitution had 9 articles in it, and the canons, there were 17 of them for a total of 9 pages. That just blows me away that for our very first period of time, we really had very little structure to our governance, but we made it.
We did. And
we kept on adding to it. I like to think about it as we used to have 10 commandments, and then we got Leviticus.
I think there's lots of good added in the things over the years. And the wonderful thing is, right, we can keep changing them. So we can both add to them and amend them and take pieces out that are no longer relevant. Although mostly it would seem numerically that we just keep adding.
We do. Sometimes we take out those criteria that it has to be a man to do.
Right.
Or something like that. And those have been good additions. But I do have a favorite canon from the very beginning. You know that I do a lot of work with clergy discipline, which is
Yes. Four
of our canons. And there was, you know, we now have pages and pages of Title IV. It started out with one canon, teen. And I love the title of it, Sober Conversation Required in Ministers. And basically what it says is that no clergy person, well, clergy man at the time, other than for their honest necessities, and I have no idea what that means, may resort to taverns or other places most liable to be abused for licentiousness. So you can't go to a tavern, I guess, unless you're there to evangelize the sinners, right?
Right, or maybe that you're traveling and it's the only place you can get food or to stay or something. Like you can go there out of absolute necessity, but you really should sort of pretend you're not there, I think.
Yep, and they were not to give themselves to any base or service labor or to drinking or riot or to spending their time idly. It's fascinating what they were concerned about at the time, right after the American Revolution.
Yes.
I'm not advocating riots or anything, but clearly that was an issue with them. Our canon doesn't look much, our canons don't look much like this anymore. It has changed over time. But to me, that's just a fascinating part of our history.
That is. We would think, so clearly idly doesn't mean Sabbath, like we're supposed to take time off and have rest and things like that, but not be idle.
You got to wonder what was idle back in the late 1700s.
Right.
And, you know, our friend Ian Douglas can probably answer that.
He probably could. I would guess, Ian Douglas or Sally Johnson would be able to.
That's right.
Well, I suppose we can go to our written resource of White and Dyckman, right? We have that wonderful commentary on Constitution and Canon, see how we got there and how it's changed over the course of the years. It is so much fun to dig into the history and to see how all the things that have stayed the same and all the things that have changed over the centuries.
I agree. For those who don't know, Ian Douglas is the retiring Bishop of Connecticut, and he is the ultimate church history nerd for the Episcopal Church. I think he would wear that title proudly. I have learned more about our history just from sitting down and talking with Ian, but it is interesting that we do have so many canons and so many changes that we actually do have a book of the annotation of the changes, and that it really does help a lot. And a lot of folks don't know that we do have that resource, and you can actually download a PDF of most of it anyway, can't we? Still off of
Yes.
the General Convention page.
And the archives.
The archives. That's right.
Yep. And it's a good thing we have it written down, because the other person we mentioned, Sally Johnson, who's currently the chancellor to the president of the House of Deputies, she will probably retire at some point, which would also be extraordinarily well deserved because she's given decades of service to the church. And she has most of the Constitution and canons in her brain. It's really astounding. And she can usually tell you how and when it was changed in the last, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And so we do need all of that written down, because we won't always have the benefit of her incredible mind, and Ian is about to retire. So we're at a real turning point of leadership in the church in lots of ways.
While I will miss those folks, even though I'm sure I'll keep up with them, I am really excited about getting new leadership and some new ideas. We are a church with an old history, especially if we go back to our connection with the Catholic Church before the English Reformation. But we are also a church that's looking toward the future. And I like the fact that one of the things we get to do at General Convention is look at what do we want to be, not just who are we now and what is our present situation, but where we're going.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that will happen in so many ways through the election of new leaders and through the changes in our own structure and governance and how we are in the world and the choices we make about how we spend our tremendous financial resources. I think it's a really exciting time to be a part of the church and to have this opportunity to really make a profound impact in the world because of what we believe and how we are in the world and the resources that we have to put behind those beliefs. And it's really exciting to see what will happen.
Well, on that note, Molly, it's time for us to wrap this up. I sure appreciate you joining us this morning, and I look forward to seeing you at General Convention along with the rest of your team. Appreciate the hard work that I know that General Convention Office does to make this happen. And as we sign off, I would remind the listeners that the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee is on Facebook, Instagram, and you can also find us on our website at edwtn.org. And you can listen to past episodes of Faithfully Memphis wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, including Spotify. This is Sharon Alexander, Canon to the Ordinary in the Diocese of West Tennessee for Faithfully Memphis. Until the next time, stay safe and stay positive.